Welcome everyone to iloverealestate.tv. I'm sitting here today with my lawyer. Now, Calvin has been my lawyer for, probably 19 years or something like that. So to be keeping him as my lawyer for all of that time, he must know some stuff. He must be all right at his job. What do you reckon? I think he is. Now, his name is Calvin Kong. You're ready to have a bit of a chat to everybody.
Yes, I am, Dipna, with my imaginary cup of tea. So we're having this cup of tea and having a chat about contracts.
That's it. Do you want to talk about contracts? Contracts are a good thing to talk about.
I love contracts. Contracts are my life.
You're a boring lawyer. You really are.
I love reading them. I so love reading them.
Okay, so let's talk about perhaps some of the traps that you've seen.
Yeah.
And what people can do to really kind of, you know, make sure that they're not putting themselves in a bad situation.
Yep.
And don't, you know, commit to obligations and things that they just simply can't do.
Look, absolutely. And we see this on a daily basis with the things that, even the simple things that can go wrong. I don't actually have to think very far, and I'm thinking about, let's say, yesterday.
What happened yesterday, Calvin?
Well, yesterday we had this situation where, and you'd think something as simple as a name on a contract would be something that people will get right. But unfortunately, even with those things, when they go wrong, it then involves getting lawyers involved, and then it increases costs. And that's the thing that I guess will make people sort of pay attention.
So what happened?
What happened was we act for a seller. So simple, right? And then, but the complicating factor was we had on the other side a self-acting purchaser, and the contract.
One came, of your pet hates.
One of my pet hates.
We'll go with that.
We'll go with that.
All right.
So this person, after the contract is signed, figures out after she gets advice from her financier and her accountant to say, oh, by the way, you've got this wrong. So all of a sudden, she is self-acting. She comes to our office and says, I need this contract change, and thinks that it's just a matter of crossing off her name and putting things in. And this is where, as lawyers, we just get all jumpy and get concerned because of stamp duty implications. Now, you may think that the stamp duty implications is for the buyer to be concerned about, and that is generally true. However, from an Office of State Revenue perspective, they don't care what the contract says. They say that every party to that document is liable for the stamp duty.
Every party.
Yeah. So it is both the seller and the buyer has equal liability as far as the Office of State Revenue is concerned.
Hmm.
Within the contract, it says stamp duty is the concern of the buyer. However, if the stamps office can't track down the buyer, they will track down the seller.
Wow, I didn't know that.
So, Dipna, you've learned something new today.
Okay,
so I'm very, very glad we're doing this podcast.
So, not that I would be putting the wrong name in there. Not that I would be self-acting. And if it was wrong, guess what? It'd be your fault.
It's never my fault. That's why I've still got a job with you. So, look, in that situation, obviously, there was a bit of hoo-ha. You know, we had to fix things up. And I had to, obviously, let my client know the cost implications. And it just upsets everyone. Now, within that contract also are other things that, or within any contract really, are things that are meant to be disclosed. Things like the title encumbrances. We regularly see things like encumbrances such as easements and things like that that should be noted on on the contract, but isn't. Okay, as a buyer, obviously, sometimes that can work in your favor if, let's say, there's an easement that's meant to be noted on the contract and isn't disclosed. It means for the seller that they actually have to have that encumbrance removed. Now, some of these encumbrances cannot be removed, such as council easements.
So what's the cost implication there? Can the other side ask for damages?
The other side can say, I insist on my right to have this contract free from that encumbrance.
And what if it's a council easement that you can never get rid of? What
Correct.
Happens then?
Well, then it brings you to that situation where you love to find dimna, which is problems.
Lawyers love to find problems.
what it opens up, I guess, is the opportunity to negotiate something, right?
Yeah.
Because the seller wants to sell this thing and you are saying, well, sorry, but you've filled this thing wrong. It seems to indicate to me that this particular encumbrance is meant to come off. What are you going to do about it?
Mm.
So, you know, those are...
And there'll obviously be a compensation amount of money negotiated.
Sure. Or I'll say, well, you know what, I really wanted to bill across that line. I now can't do it. Maybe, you know, there's a big amount of dollars that need to come off the contract.
And it could be significant, like tens of thousands of dollars, maybe even hundreds of thousands.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I remember years ago when I bought a particular property I'm thinking of, and obviously you did all the work on it. The seller actually signed the contract selling me freehold title.
Yes.
When in actual fact, it was a leasehold property.
Yep.
And exactly the same thing happened. We insisted or made the seller convert it from leasehold to freehold.
Yes.
Which I didn't particularly mind at the time. It took, you know, 6-8 months or something or other to do, which means that the property market rose and I still had a fixed buy-in price. But that would have probably cost the guy $50,000.
Well, it would have cost him something he wouldn't have anticipated when
Absolutely.
He signed that contract with you. and you would have had the uplift of a freehold property as opposed to a leasehold property.
That's right.
So that was a very nice win for you in that circumstance. So.
And this is something that, you know, dealing with a property lawyer who deals with property stuff all the time will be able to pick that sort of thing up. Whereas, you know, somebody else who's perhaps doesn't do as much property as you do, it would have just got swept under the carpet and nobody would have known about it.
Absolutely, and that's right. And in that particular situation, dimna, we obviously got a great result for you.
Yeah.
That's
why you're still my lawyer.
I thought it was my good looks.
Oh, is that what it is? One of the many reasons.
The other things that, you know, we typically see, and these are the ones that most people are familiar with the building and pests clauses and the finance clauses. We have talked a bit sometimes in seminars
things,
about the treatment of these things, but we still see them come through where building and pests clauses especially may not have the impact or the force that you want it to have. I saw one, I think it may have been Tuesday last week. So again, you know, these
recently.
Are things, yeah, recently,
yep.
Where the pests and building clause was a special condition and it was about a page long. And it said things like, yes, it's subject to building and pests and yes, it's 14 days. But if you only find structural damage or live termite infestation, then you can terminate. Again, I may have mentioned this previously. It's very rare that a building is about to fall down, which is structural issues, or that you will find live termites in there. Fortunately, in that particular contract, it was still within the cooling off period when we saw it, and they also had a good finance clause in there, which meant, you know, if we had to do something about it, they wouldn't be tied up in that contract.
Mm. So there was an out for that particular individual, but obviously it's not something that, you know, you want to do on a regular basis. And it's also something that, you know, real estate agents, you know, they can be your best mates and they find your deals and they're, you know, they're great to have on your team, but they are not lawyers.
No.
And consequently, when they're writing in clauses into contracts because they want a sale,
yes,
they may or may not be fully educated in what those clauses really need to say. And if you, as the buyer or the seller, are not fully educated, you can get yourself into all sorts of trouble.
Yeah, look, I think that's very true. With, you know, sometimes the agent really is trying to help, and you know, we sometimes have. chats with our client before they sign contracts, and they say to the agent, oh, I need clauses to say that the contract is subject to, let's say, due diligence. And sometimes we will find the contracts actually just saying that as a special condition, this contract is subject to a due diligence. And that's all the words that they put in there.
Oh, no.
I know. So it is just, again, you know, that in itself will not be sufficient to do what you want it to do, okay? Because all it says is it's subject to due diligence, and what does due diligence mean? And if you find something you're not happy with, what are your rights? Because it's silent on it.
Yeah. So it doesn't actually say what you can do.
Correct.
If you find something that you don't like.
Yeah.
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 Now, there's a lot of hidden things in contracts that unless you know, are a lawyer and used to looking at them, you just miss. There's a few things in the sideline of some contracts.
Correct.
in the side columns in tiny little writing that
Absolutely.
Mean a lot.
Yes. Look, typically these standard, let's call them standard contracts, run to about 20-odd pages. The first 5, 6, 7, 8 pages are schedules to be filled in. So there's lots of information to complete, lots of information to digest. So unless you are familiar with how these schedules work and how they sort of speak to the conditions within the contract, you could easily trip yourself up. The point that Dipna has raised here is that in some contracts there are marginal notes, let's call them that, and they are in a much smaller font that is actually quite difficult to read. And some of them say things like, unless these three items are filled in properly, that clause does not apply. And that typically appears in the finance clauses that are...
That's when they say things like how much money you're borrowing and who you're borrowing it from and how long you've got on a finance clause. All things which I refuse to tell somebody.
Yep, absolutely. And you shouldn't have to because those things are, I guess...
they're confidential. Absolutely. They're nobody else's business.
That's right. It's no one
so
else's
how do you get
business.
Rid of them? How do you get rid of them? How do you not fill them in or you fill them in to a vague degree?
We use legal speak here.
Legal speak.
Yeah, legal speak. It's our code, right?
Is that expensive?
Very. I'm glad you raised that point.
Okay.
look, we use, terminology that is sufficient to give enough clarity, but is, I guess, vague enough, but it's sort of...
But it fulfills the clause
fulfills
if something's filled in.
Correct.
Yeah.
For instance, you know, it may say, you know, what amount of finance are you getting? We put in things like, you know, sufficient to complete the contract. So whatever that number may be for me...
Is my business. Yeah.
So, and also...
And from a financial institution to the buyer's satisfaction.
Correct. So I can choose whatever bank I want. I don't need to tell you I'm going to the, you know, whatever big bank or small bank you want to use.
Yeah. Okay. And then within a certain time frame.
And those things need to be completed. If it's not completed, there's going to be a question mark. Well, in fact, there's no question mark. It doesn't apply. The clause does not apply. And we still see, typically, you know, maybe once a month, and we see quite a few contracts, maybe once or twice a month, actually, those clauses not completed properly, which means then if we're acting for the buyer, have to go back and retrace those things and talk to other people, talk to the other lawyers to activate those clauses properly. And again, these things add cost to the process that could be alleviated if we get to have a look at them at the before it's signed up.
Mm. You know, some of the things that that students come to talk to me about, and I guess it's more the process rather than the actual contract, of when they go to settle on the property. And, you know, there's a due time that that things are going to happen. And, in fact, somebody who I actually thought would have known this earlier this week asked me, what actually happens at settlement? Like, do you all turn up at the same place and hand checks over and the bank is there and the other banks, you know, the seller's bank is there and the lawyer on each side is there and you stand there and you swap checks and what do you actually do?
Actually, that's a great question. I've never really, I guess, had to explain that to clients.
You sit around and have a cup of tea or what do you do?
We do have a cup of tea because it's a fantastic thing to do.
It means you actually get out of the office.
Not me personally.
Oh, you don't let you out of the office.
No, they don't let me out of the office. Look, for those, I guess it's interesting if you are not aware what actually happens. Yes, there is an actual physical exchange of papers and checks. And obviously a lot of work has to have happened for that sort of, you know, 2 seconds or, you know, 2 minutes exchange.
Do you sit around a table? What do you do?
We do sit around a table. Sometimes it's on a counter on a bank somewhere, but typically the parties involved will be the releasing bank, so the seller's bank, and they will have a release of mortgage. Then you'll have the advancing bank, so the buyer's bank, and they will want to take the release of mortgage. Then there's the transfer document that is also handed over, and that generally has to be stamped as well. Then you may have the seller's lawyers there to pick up the checks to be paid, and you have the buyer's lawyers there that hands over all the checks. So that typically, you know, that four parties, I guess, will attend.
They all have to be physically in one jurisdiction at the one time?
One place, one time, yes.
Now, what happens if you've got a, a seller in Brisbane and a buyer on the Sunshine Coast?
We generally, again, now what dictates the place is generally the releasing bank's call, because they say, well, we have something valuable you want, you come to my place to get the release. So that's generally what happens. The bank dictates where it occurs. Then as conveyancing lawyers or property lawyers, we then have to organize where it occurs. Now, a lot of these transactions are happening with the major banks. I would say, you know, 80 to 90% of them happen in the major banks, the big four. And even the smaller banks like St. George or of that sort of ilk, they have branches all over the place. So you can generally get them to settle at a town near you, so to speak. So generally that is not a huge issue, regardless of where the lawyers are and where the banks are and where the buyer and seller are. It's
so the lawyers have to travel? Or the lawyers appoint somebody locally?
Correct. For instance, let's say, you know, if I'm on the Sunshine Coast and we have a lot of settlements happening in Brisbane, and even sometimes if they're happening on, let's say, the Sunshine Coast, we have outside clerks or outside agents that attend for us with the checks, with the paperwork, because it's actually more effective with someone that's doing that all the time than someone from, let's say, my office having to go in and out of the office all the time. It's a much...
Disruptive.
Yeah, it's disruptive, and it's more economical to use people that, you know, charge maybe $50 to do that.
To hand over paperwork.
Yeah, to handle paperwork.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Something else that I do get asked all the time is you've got settlement, and settlement's coming up, and it's going to settle at 2 o'clock.
Yes.
Yeah. What should you do on the day?
What you should do on the day... you would have hoped that you would have not a lot to do, okay? Now, it's very different if you're buying your principal place of residence as opposed to, let's say, you're buying an investment property. If you're buying a principal place of residence, obviously you have to have organized your removalers, changeover of electricity, all that type of stuff. If you're buying an investment property, if you've got a tenant in there, obviously you need to make sure the paperwork to change over tenancy details, managing agents, all that sort of stuff is all organized. But generally, as the buyer or the seller, if you have engaged your lawyers, most of the organizing would have been done by your lawyers. If they've done the right job at the right time, there shouldn't really be a lot for you to do. There may be things you may need to do to, you know, organize your bank a little bit, but generally not too much.
It's something that I like to do regardless of whether it's an investment property or a principal place of residence purchase, is actually have a pre-settlement inspection.
Yes.
Now, the pre-settlement inspection, if you're buying a place remotely where you're not actually physically in that location, the person I would have to go back and do the inspection on the property would be probably the building inspector that I employed to go through that property to check it out in the first place.
Yep.
Because a lot of things can happen between signing the contract and settlement day. And if you don't have that pre-purchase inspection and make sure that everything is physically there that should be there, you settle on the property, it's too late. You know, your opportunity to say anything or get compensated for anything is gone.
Yeah. Look, this, you know, maybe if people think about this, it's like once money is handed over, especially the bulk of it, people lose interest.
Yep.
You may have all the rights in the world to insist, please return back my pot plants. Please return back my bath.
We're laughing at that because on one of my properties, right, it wasn't where I was living. It was just an investment property. I was going to, I don't know, subdivide or something. I can't remember now. And I got the building inspector to go back through who had originally checked out the building to make sure it was, you know, structurally sound and all that kind of stuff. And he rings me up at, you know, I don't know, 11 o'clock and settlement's at 2 o'clock. And he goes, now, I went through this place a month or so ago and I haven't got it in my notes, but I'm sure there was a bath here. The people had taken a bath. I mean, it's not something you would normally have taken. But look, I have had little old ladies. They are the worst. Honestly, they go around and they take all the plants out of the garden that are dug into the garden, and in their place they'll put a cutting. It's like,
well, yeah. I mean, it does highlight, doesn't it, Dipna, that pre-settlement inspection really should be done, because sometimes you'll find damage that may have occurred.
It could be from storm or weather.
Correct.
You know, you can have junk lying around, you can have a tree through the roof, you can have all sorts of things that you don't know about, particularly if it's not a place that, you know, you live close to.
Yeah, the junk one is also an interesting one that we see from time to time, where they'll, you know, clients will ring up and say, Calvin, the car bodies that are there are still there. They're meant to have been removed. Or, you know, all the stuff that's in the lockup, it's still all there, bits of timber, bits of, you know, scrap metal, everything. So, you know, there's a cost to remove these things, and the time to get that done is before you pay over the settlement monies.
And also in the contract too, because say you inspect a place that's full of crap, you know, you do have car bodies lying around and bits and pieces and whatever, you can actually put it into the contract that all has to be removed at settlement, because otherwise they can leave it all there and then it's at your cost that you have to get rid of it. So if there is anything, those type of circumstances where you particularly want something to be left or removed, put it in the contract, and then just before settlement, as in hours before settlement, make sure that that is then done.
Yeah, that's absolutely a very, very good point, is to make sure that you let your lawyer know, let us know what is important for you, especially with things like rubbish in the premises, whether it needs to be in or out. Otherwise, it's cost for you at the end to sort out.
Mm. Did you see the one in the paper? I can't remember where it was. Was it in Italy? It wasn't an Australian one, but I thought it was interesting. They were digging, they decided to put a pool in the backyard.
Yes.
And they dug up a 1974 brand new Ferrari.
Wow.
Yeah.
Buried in concrete.
Well, it was actually when they chased it back, it was an interesting story. When they chased it back, the Ferrari was an insurance job.
Wow.
They had paid some thugs to take the car and, you know, drive it into the ocean so that they could claim their insurance.
Right.
But what they actually did was they buried it in the, in this backyard and completely covered it up and everything. And then they got put in jail for something else. And ultimately, the car has sat there for like nearly 50 years.
Wow.
And it's worth a fortune.
That's unreal.
Some guy in America bought it. Anyway, that's totally off track.
Absolutely.
I wouldn't mind one of those being left behind.
Yeah, but I don't think that will make me start digging my backyard up.
Well, you never know what's buried back there.
It wouldn't be a car. Probably dead animals.
Ah, dear.
Look, the other things, you know, with contracts, and I guess the principle that Dipna raises, you know, letting us know what is on the properties is a very important thing in terms of tips and traps of contracting safely. If we don't know what is important to you, we don't know what to put into contracts to protect you. It could be as simple things like tenants. You know, you're buying an investment property, and this is where we think we are different in that we actually ask our clients, why are you buying this property? We know you're buying a property. Yes, we know it's a house. We know it's a unit, etc. And that's, you know, interesting. But the interesting thing for me is really, why are you doing this? Is there something special about this property? What are the development potential for this property? Is that what you're looking for? Is this a chunk deal that you're doing something with? Is it for a buy and hold because it's a very good tenant? Because if it's that, then the value in that, apart from the structure, is of course the strength of the tenancy agreement and the tenant at some level. So the more we know about these things, about why, the why will drive how we protect you.
And what kind of searches and all sorts of things need to be done?
Absolutely. You know, I don't have to think too far back when I had a client that was looking to buy a property for student accommodation. So now, let's say you went to a conveyance and just say, oh, I've signed a contract, and that's all they'll do. They'll just transfer that property from you to from the seller to you. We ask you, why are you buying this property? I'm going to put student accommodation in there. Then we then have to start looking at things like the zoning around there, any town planning issues, any council approvals that may be required. And out of that deal, I recall council had to do a lot of stuff, or you had to have some town planning applications through. It meant there was a lot of cost involved. The client then decided not to go ahead because of the cost. But we put in enough clauses in there to allow the client enough time to carefully look through and consider these issues. And then, you know, when the time was right, we could just walk that person out of that contract and safeguarded the deposit, which was tens of thousands of dollars.
Yeah. Very, very good point there. I want to talk about inclusions
yes.
in contracts.
Yep.
Typically, anything that is part of the property, as in a fixture to the property, does not have to be specifically named in the contract.
Correct.
But things that are perhaps on wheels or, even though they might appear to be part of a cupboard, but they're actually just sitting in the shelf, if you
yep.
like a fancy microwave or a coffee machine or
yep.
a dishwasher on wheels and that kind of stuff. They actually have to be specifically mentioned to leave them there. Otherwise, they can be taken.
Absolutely. Fixtures are part of the house. And, what constitutes a fixture is, I apologize for how this sounds, but it's the level of annexation or fixation to that property.
Good Lord.
I know.
Is that more lawyer speak?
Yeah, it's terrible, isn't it?
It's awful.
Yeah. It's how stuck it is to the property. Is that better? And I don't mean by araldite either, okay? So things like aerials, okay, it's sort of fixed to the building. Yeah, they sort of come with it. But again, with, let's say, the aerial, you could easily unscrew it and take it with you. But generally, antennas and things like that are stuck to the house. It becomes part of the house. Ovens are part of the houses. Dishwashers are not part of the house. So you will have to specify that the dishwasher comes with it if you expect it to come with it. Coffee machines could or could not be. There are some coffee machines that are sort of built in. Into cabinetry, that sort of stuff will stay with the house.
It's plumbed in generally.
Yeah, it's plumbed in, so it's affixed to the house. So that sort of will determine
there's it. There's fridges now that are plumbed in, though, and well, they normally wouldn't be included.
A plumbed-in fridge, I think, is not included.
Mm.
Okay, so this is why, if you're unsure, you have to let us know.
And water filters and all these types of things that, you know, even if you're buying a house for yourself to live in, it's not even an investment property.
Correct.
They all have to be considered.
Correct.
Because otherwise you can, you know, things can be taken out of the building that might add up to $5,000-$10,000.
Easily.
Yeah.
And so if you are concerned, or if you think that there is a question mark about, is that in part of it, not part of it, you let us know, we put it in and remove all doubt. You know, sometimes being doubly sure is not a bad thing, especially we're talking about tens of thousands of dollars. I'd rather, you know, spend a couple of $100 and get it right, and as opposed to just hoping that someone thinks the way you are thinking about.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, well, look, there's probably enough there for everybody to chew on this time and
wonderful.
And talk about contracts and some of the bits and pieces in there. So thank you for coming along and sharing your wealth of knowledge.
Thank you, Dipna.
And guys, as per usual, refer it to your mates. Make sure they don't get caught in any contracts that, you know, that they shouldn't be entering, and make sure that they know all of these rules and regs as well. So get these podcasts out to your mates and subscribe to iTunes so they come down to you automatically. Thank you for Calvin for being here. Now, oh, wait, who are you from? I forgot to tell everybody.
I'm from Pacific Law. We're a firm in based in Queensland, but we do work all around Australia. So Google us, pacificlaw.com.au.
I had your mate in here the other day, Derek, talking about wills.
Derek, great guy.
Great guy.
Nice beard.
And he needs to get rid of that scruff on his face, I can tell you.
Thank you, Dipna.
Thanks, guys. Talk to you again soon. Bye for now.